MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
I'm Michael Isikoff, and welcome to another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. Jeff Stein can't be with us today, and Karen Greenberg will be joining us in a moment, but we're going to dispense with the usual week in review discussion we have, because we've got a really special guest, actually guests, coming on to discuss what may have been the biggest, most colossal intelligence failure in the CIA's history. And I'm speaking, of course, about the saga of Curveball, the Iraqi exile whose claims about mobile biological labs inside Iraq were used as a principal justification for the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. You go back to Colin Powell's speech to the UN and the Curveball claims. He doesn't use the name, of course, but the assertions are front and center in Powell's speech. They're mentioned by Bush in his 2003 State of the Union. And in my own reporting at the time, these reports coming in from the Germans about the claims of this guy Curveball were absolutely essential to the Bush administration's case for war. And of course, we now know it was all baloney. Curveball was a fabricator from the outset. So we're gonna talk to a CIA operative and analyst who had a catbird seat into the Curveball fiasco. Jerry Watson, a 31-year veteran of the CIA, who's written a huge book about the Curveball story that he's trying to get cleared by the CIA, and the CIA is balking at it, so he's now suing his former employer. And we're also going to hear from Bob Drogon, the former Los Angeles Times reporter who wrote a key book about Curveball many years ago. So it's quite a discussion. It's a long one, but a one well worth listening to. So without further ado, let's go right to our interview with Jerry Watson. Okay, we are now joined by Jerry Watson, former veteran CIA covert operative and analyst, who is now suing his former employer, the CIA. And we're going to dig into that. It's over a book he has written, a massive book, I think over 1,000 pages, documenting what many feel is like the most colossal intelligence failure, perhaps in the CIA's history. Jerry, welcome to Spy Talk.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate you having me here.
This is a subject of great interest to me, and I'm sure a lot of Spy Talk listeners. But let's just walk us through, first of all, your background at the CIA, what you did very briefly, and how you got on to the case of Curveball.
Okay. Basically, I started with the CIA in 1986, April of 1986. And I had applied to a lot of different government agencies while I was in graduate school. The process is very slow for finally getting in. Anyway, I did finally get in 1986. I came in to the director of operations as a case officer, went through all the training and everything, was posted overseas, did my first tour, and then returned back to the United States. I had married an analyst at the CIA, which actually makes it very convenient.
Yeah,
because we both have the security clearances and have gone through all that process. So you
don't have to worry about disclosing anything in pillow talk.
No, but I mean, our issues would overlap sometimes. And right. And so we'd pass in the kitchen a lot in the middle of the night because she was going off to brief and I'm just coming home from writing finished intelligence, and we'd sort of pass in the kitchen sometimes because she had to go in early and I came home late. But anyway, so...
Can I just say, I was fascinated. One of the nuggets in Bob Drogan's piece that he wrote for Spy Talk about you, a two-parter, is that your marriage with a fellow CIA person is not unique. In fact, there's a whole section on the CIA's website, Love at Langley.
Yeah, I think that was part of a push to sort of be family friendly. Because when we got married in 1988, just before we went overseas, they were not happy that I was getting married. I remember my personnel officer, when she heard it, was very disappointed and said, you know, we had such plans for you. And the reason is because when you're a case officer and you get married, now the agency has to deal not only with your needs, but now a spouse. And at that time, it was a very male-dominated organization, and they really didn't want to have to deal with somebody else just because you wanted to get married. So now they realize that as time goes on, people do get married, and they've got to deal with this issue. So they're trying to be more family-friendly, and I think and more people started to get married from inside the agency, but also marrying people from outside, because then they have to go through a process to make sure they're approved by the agency, because if they don't approve that person, you'll have to resign.
But they don't have to approve your marriage, I assume.
No, but they'll decide whether or not that person is approved for you to be married to them while you work there. If they don't trust that person, then you're told to resign.
So whether it's a liability or not.
Right.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. So anyway, so I went in, I did that I was a case officer for about 10 years. And then I decided case officers are generalists. So I wanted to be, I was jealous of the analysts. I wanted to be an expert on an issue. So I moved over to the director of intelligence where the analysts are, and became an analyst. And for the first, it must have been 6 years, I worked with providing intelligence support and material support for the inspections in Iraq for the UN weapons inspectors. We would help through working through an office at the U.S. Department of State. We would help provide personnel to go on these inspections, the material they need, you know, any sort of support, because this was, of course, in the interest of the United States government to have these inspections. So I did that for a while, and then I moved over to be a line analyst, and my account was on Iraq. I was one of three analysts on what was called the Iraq BW team for biological warfare. We had three analysts. One did focused on research and development. Another focused on BW agent production, and mine was on weaponization. And that's how I got involved in the whole Iraq issue and on Curveball.
And one point that Bob made in his piece that I think in retrospect is pretty significant in trying to understand how the CIA got things so wrong about Iraqi WMD. And it dates back to, I guess, what was it, December 98, Clinton bombs Iraq because he says they're not fulfilling their inspection requirements.
They were blocking the inspections and obstructing them and not being fully transparent. And that was Desert Fox when they bombed in December of 1998. Right. So I was there in 1998 in the summer. And
were you in Iraq?
Yeah, I was a weapons inspector. Right, we were running out of personnel to send over there because they all had technical expertise. And when we were starting to, when that pool gets smaller, after you send people over for three or four times, they start to say, well, I can't go again. I got a job. I got family. And so we're running out of people to send that were qualified. So some of us would volunteer and say, well, we'll go. And so that's what I did. So I was there during the summer of 1998. And yes, the Iraqis obstructed us. We had a kind of a battle with them at the Air Force headquarters over a document we found in a safe that gave the actual accounting numbers for the actual amount of CW chemical weapons that were used during the Iran-Iraq war. That was very important to material balance. If they use this much, how much do they have left? And so that contradicted right. what the Iraqis had officially given us. So that turned into a real battle where it got pretty tense, but we made it out of
it. The point I was going to make about that, though, is mm-hmm. as obstructive as they were prior to the bombing, after the bombing, Saddam kicks the inspectors out. And so now you've got no, if I understand it correctly, no window into what Iraq is up to at all.
Yeah, actually, the inspectors left Iraq because things were getting too dangerous. And mm-hmm. what Saddam did is, after the bombing, he just didn't allow them back in. So the U.S. government, of course, is now concerned, President Clinton at the time, you know, because now we have no eyes. We don't know what's going on in the country. We really didn't have a lot of sources there of our own. The UN, we weren't spying on the UN. We were trying to help them in their inspections. But we need
that was my question. How did the UN? I'm just curious about that relationship between you and the UN and how that conversation went, and you know who reported to whom. You know what I'm saying? Was there a formal sure. process for reporting in, or what was that?
Well, again, we were interested in what UNSCOM is finding out on the ground in Iraq, of course. And through our support, we can learn some of that. Now, we weren't spying on them. This was voluntary on their part, and they didn't have to tell us anything if they didn't want to. But we needed a dialogue so that we could help them with, hey, here's some intelligence. You might check out this site, or you know, if you need some support over here, we can provide that. Because again, it's in the U.S. interest. We weren't the only ones doing this. All the other countries involved were doing the same thing, and they were so they didn't necessarily report to us or even share us information. But we would talk to some of the inspectors who would come back and debrief them. That was my job for 6 years. Is the analyst contacted me and said, hey, can you go contact these American inspectors who were on these teams and see if they're willing to be debriefed voluntarily? So I did that. And that we got a lot of good information off that. You know, and again, I want to stress the UN is not, you know, they're not allowing a bunch of spies in there. They need the support. And this is one way we could leverage that support is, can you let us know what's happening right. too?
And I should point out, we've just been joined by Bob Drogan, storied former Los Angeles Times reporter and author of, until now, the definitive book on Curveball, the subject of our talk today. So, Bob, right. welcome to Spy Talk here.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So I'm gonna like continue with Jerry, and then we'll bring you into the discussion to give us your thoughts on what he's had to say. But just picking up on where we left off, Jerry. So in 2000, Clinton leaves, well, 2001, Clinton leaves office. Were you convinced that Iraq had WMD, and how solid, if so, was your conviction that it still had chemical and biological weapons?
Yeah. And I addressed this in my book. We were not fully convinced. We believed that WMD may be there because Saddam made WMD before, so he obviously knows how to make it. So he can make it again. He's still got the same people. He's got the material. So we analysts, intelligence analysts, not just in the U.S. but also the Brits and the Germans. We were following this, trying to figure out where anything is. But yes, we did believe it was there. But because we didn't have concrete, solid, you know, intelligence saying they really did have it, we had to use qualifiers and caveats on our reporting. So we had to say Saddam may have a weapons program. He may have WMD. He could be doing this. And that's important because unless you are 100% convinced and you can prove that, you really can't say Saddam has WMD. You have to say he may have it.
Well, so that's what brings us to, you know, what changed. And one of the big things that changed was the reports that start coming in from the Germans about a guy codenamed Curveball.
Right.
So
let's get right to that. And when you first heard and saw these reports, sure, and what your reaction was.
Okay. So again, before I went into the Iraq BW team, I was still doing the support for UNSCOM. So Curveball showed up in Germany late November 1999. And he had traveled from Iraq and on his own and got there. The Germans picked him up, as Bob has said, out of the Zirndorf refugee community. And they started to debrief him because he had some very interesting information. With emigres, you want to go through the emigres in your country and talk to them and find out, do any of them have any good information that intelligence would like to have? And so every country does this. So, of course, the Germans were doing that at Zirndorf, trying to find out, do any of these emigres know anything? So they got to Rafid, to Curveball, and he told them this story about these mobile VW plants. They started disseminating, they started sharing that information with what was called Defense Human Service at the time. That's the operational collection arm of the Defense Intelligence Agency. So they had a close relationship, closer than CIA did, with the Germans because of the history. I mean, it goes back decades. So the Germans started sharing the information, Curveball's reporting, with Defense Human. Defense Human would disseminate that to the U.S. intelligence community, and we analysts would see these reports. So that's really when it started, in January and February of 2000. The first time I ever heard of this guy was not until summer of 2000, where I'm still doing the UNSCOM support work. And at that time, I was working with UNSCOM on, we had concerns that the Iraqis had restarted a UAV program that would produce UAVs that could carry spray tanks to deliver BW. This was a real actual program declared by the Iraqis back in 1991. So in 1995, all of a sudden, we see them restarting what appeared to be this same program. So the senior analyst on the Iraq BW team, before I moved to that office, she came to see me and said, hey, can a liquid slurry of BW agent, which is what Curveball is saying is produced in these mobile BW plants, can that be used in aerial spray tanks? And I said, absolutely. That's perfect for it. So that increased her confidence, and of course, it increased my confidence and in our assessments. And so she just said, well, the German BND has this source. He's an Iraqi engineer. And that's all I knew. And that's all she would share with me. Because his reporting, ever since the beginning, was in restricted channels. And I was not read into it. She was, and so was a junior analyst that she worked with. And so that's all they told me. Later on, in September of 2001, just before 9/11, I moved over and became a member of that Iraq BW team. And mine's on weaponization. So Curveball didn't have any information on weaponization. So I'm not ready into the program still in 2001, but they were. So I only knew what they were telling me. And they would tell me a lot of the good things, but they never really told me any of the bad things that they were finding out about them. So that caused a problem.
I want to get to that in a moment. And by the way, the full name of Curveball is Rafid Ahmed Al-Janabi. And when these reports start circulating, mm-hmm, by the Defense Intelligence Agency, and there's something like 90 such reports that get filed over that time, that, yeah, really does change the calculus on what the CIA thought it knew about WMD. And maybe I'll bring Bob in at this point. How significant were these reports from DIA about Curveball's claims in the intelligence community's assessment of WMD and, of course, in the Bush administration's case as well?
So my understanding is, and it's been a while since I've been involved on this, but my understanding is when he first came out at the end of 99 and started speaking to the BND all through 2000 and 2001, and they're filing these reports, it wasn't getting a whole lot of notice. What happened was 9/11, And after 9/11, when suddenly the Bush administration, the White House, is suddenly looking for, is suddenly accusing Saddam Hussein of somehow being involved with 9/11, which was the CIA pushed back on. The CIA did not push back on at all on this question of WMD, which the Dick Cheney and others in the administration were really harping on by the mid, by the middle of 2002 or so. When Jerry said a minute ago that there were caveats and they may have this and they may have that, by the fall of 2002, when the CIA and the whole national intelligence community issued something called the National Intelligence Estimate, right, which is supposed to be the gold standard of finished intelligence products, and sends it over to Congress. And normally those kinds of things take, I'm told, 6 months, 8 months, a long, long time through a very extensive review process. They banged that puppy out in something like 19 days. And it did not have those caveats and did not have any of those things. It just says, we assess he has with high confidence and so on. And in the case of, to answer your question specifically, Mike, when partly because the it in the 1990s, right, when UNSCOM was in Iraq and is conducting all of these inspections, and they find this enormous chemical weapons program that bigger than they expected, right? They find a biological weapons program that they did not anticipate, and it's more sophisticated than they knew. And they find a nascent nuclear program that they had not anticipated, right? So they are seeing this stuff. So we move up to 2002, and suddenly because of Curveball and the reporting that builds up around it, they suddenly have this high confidence that he has a biological weapons program. And the guys over on the chemical weapons side, and it's a lot easier to make mm-hmm. chemical weapons agents. They're basically pesticides with, you know, juicing them up a little bit. It's a very, it, you know, they've been used since World War I. When they read that and they learn that the BW side of the shop, right, over at where Jerry is working in the weapons side in WinPAC, that they have this guy and they are absolutely blue. They jack up their assessments, and suddenly they go from the, well, low confidence he may have. Yeah, he's definitely got it, because if he's got the BW, then these other things must be true. So it becomes sort of the tent pole in the for the CIA's assessments. So by the time Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, goes to the United Nations in February of 2003, and I'm sitting there in the Security Council, I'm watching it. And he says, first thing, biological weapons. And he pulls out this little vial of, you know, pretend anthrax or something. And he says, we have an eyewitness, right? George Tenet, the DCI, the director of Central Intelligence, is sitting right behind him and has never told him that they have never interviewed the eyewitness, the eyewitness being Curveball, who has claimed that he has been supervising them.
Supervising mobile, a mobile lab for production of biological.
Can I just ask one question here?
Yeah,
What? How much of this information was shared with UNSCOM before this, before the Powell testimony?
Before it?
Yeah.
A great deal of it.
Because, and they agreed with the assessment?
No. No, and okay. Can no, I back so, up no. one second? You have to understand the difference between the Clinton administration and the Bush administration.
Okay.
So during 2000 into 2001, President Clinton was mostly focused on domestic issues. He really turned over the foreign aspect to Al Gore, to Vice President Al Gore. And so everybody at that point believed that Saddam was contained. He's in the box. Because UNSCOM, the UN is all over him. He can't really do anything. They're all over the country. And that was very true. And then Curveball was reporting through 2000 and into 2001, and his story starts to fall apart because people are investigating what his claims are, and there's contradictions up the wazoo. I mean, things are coming
out. Walk us through a little more, Jerry, who he was and what were the contradictions that started to emerge in his story.
And who pointed them out?
The information was being shared, and I was allowed by the agency to say this, but the information was not just shared with CIA and DIA from the German V&D, but the Germans were also sharing it with the British SIS, Secret Intelligence Service, MI6. So, of course, when any of us get this kind of information, we're going to try and go check it out. And that really, that's what the Germans wanted us to do. They were a smaller service. They're fairly limited in what they can really vet as far as the information and check out. But we have more resources, and so do the Brits. And so they share it with us, asking us, please give us your evaluation of his information. And so that's what we attempted to do, is go check this out. Well, the Brits were much more successful than we were. They, one of the people one of the Iraqi engineers that Kerbal implicated in his story was a guy named Dr. Basil Alsati. He was the head of the engineering center where Kerbal worked. And he had emigrated from Iraq. His son was living in the UK, he was pre-med, and he was at Sheffield University, which is where his dad went to school. So the Brits, of course, immediately go to the son, and because they're trying to get contact with the dad. They're reading all this stuff about your dad was involved in this mobile VW plant project and all. So they go to the kid and they ask him, and he's this young guy. And Kerbal had implicated the son in this project. And the Brits see this young guy and they're thinking, wait a minute, this kid, this young guy is supposedly involved in some secret project by Saddam. So anyway, the kid, they really say, where's your dad? We want to talk to your dad. Oh, well, they're thinking the dad is still in Iraq. And he says, no, my dad's in Dubai. Here, you want his phone number and his email? Here you go. You know, so the Brits are thinking, wait a minute. Why is this, if this guy is so important to this top secret project in Iraq, what's he doing being allowed to emigrate to Dubai? So they went and found him in Dubai and they talked to him. And Basil came out years ago on 60 Minutes and told everything about this, how he'd been debriefed on all this. So that's where things started to go wrong, because Dr. Basil Alsati, who was codenamed Red River, and that's been on 60 Minutes, that was just a British nickname that they gave him. So we could all talk, all these different intelligence services could talk to each other, and we'd use these sort of nicknames. But the Brits were the ones who gave these names out to everybody. Anyway, so with Basil Alsati.
But the Brits had never talked to Kerbal either.
No, the Germans wouldn't let any of us talk to him directly.
And DIA, which is circulating these reports, didn't talk to Kerbal either.
No.
Right?
So, If I can, so you asked if UNSCOM believed this. One of the missions that UNSCOM did, or multiple missions, was to try and track down. Kerbal originally had claimed he'd worked at a place called Jerf on the Daf, which is near Baghdad, a big building. And CIA had imagery and so on. And his story was that the trucks came in and they had to make a dog leg here and a turn there or something, and there was a movable wall to get it out. And they went to this site and they took ground readings and they took, you know, DNA tests and they radar images. And, you know, and the wall was very solid. There's no question. There's no movable wall. There's no secret button you could press to pull a book out and a wall opens up or anything. And CIA responds, or as I understand it, says, well, they built the wall before you came, you know, where the wall moves at night and they take it down in the morning, or, you know, it's on a hit. I mean, they came up with every kind of possible excuse to justify their own conclusion, rather than acknowledge that.
And then to answer Karen's question, they went there because we asked them to. We provided that information to them because UNMOVIC, which is the successor to UNSCOM, took over in November of 2000 and what was it, 2002, and got back into Iraq before our 2003 March war. And we gave them this information so that they could go and inspect this site. And we could already see on imagery the wall that divided the site in half. Now, Kerbal never reported a wall. So to answer Karen's questions, we started to see in 2000, we're looking at imagery of Jerf al-Nadaf, this agricultural site. It's now got a wall across it that was built in 1997. Well, Kerbal said he didn't leave until 1999. So why didn't he report a wall dividing the site in half? And as Bob pointed out, the route he said that the mobile plants took, and these are semi-trucks with a flatbed trailer with equipment mounted on it with a covering. They had to go through this wall at least twice. So how do you go through a wall? Well, they came up, the imagery analysts came up with an answer. They wrote on the satellite imagery, they annotated it with gate, G-A-T-E, with an arrow pointing at it, at the wall, at the places where the truck would cross. Amazing. And I talked to the imagery analysts later on, years later, and I said, why did you do that? And they said, I said, Kerbal never reported a gate because he never reported the wall. And they said to me, well, how else would a truck get through the wall? And I thought, you know, you just misled all the policymakers.
We do need to take a break. We will be right back. And we are back. I have to say, one of the delicious items in Bob's piece about you, Jerry, is at the time, Kerbal, the most crucial intelligence asset being used to make the case for war against Iraq, was working at a Burger King. And also, by the way, did you ever go to the Burger King, Jerry?
No, but I know where it is. Okay. Yeah, I tracked it down because I wanted to know. But he also did interviews with the press later on and talked about, and the press from The Guardian, a couple of reporters, Helen Pitt, and I'm trying to remember the other gentleman's name, they went there and actually talked to the coworkers who said, yeah, Kerbal would brag about, boast about how important he was back in Iraq. And we all thought he was full of garbage. So let me explain how that happened. So you've got 2000, he's reporting. His reporting sounded so sensational and incredible at the beginning. And this is typical with fabricators. As you start to investigate their story, it starts to crumble. And then you start to question their credibility. And it finally gets to a point where you're like, we're done. You're just lying. We're done with you. And you get rid of them. I mean, you terminate your relationship with them. I got to be careful how I say things. This was too much into Hollywood movies. So what happened here is, as we got into 2001 and his story is being checked out by the Brits and other people, it's crumbling. And so Rafat is panicking. His story is falling apart. And he's thinking, my con is going to lose. You know, I'm going to lose my the BND is giving me an apartment, supporting me, giving me a cell phone, I'm getting paid. And this is all going to come to an end, and I still don't have citizenship, which is why he did this in the first place. He was just trying to get citizenship. Kerbal is a pathological and practiced liar, and he doesn't feel any guilt for lying, which is why he can implicate everybody, including his friends, family, coworkers, anybody in his stories, and he'll stick to it to the end. And he doesn't care. He doesn't have empathy. It reminds me of someone else these days, and this is the problem. When you start to listen to pathological liars, if you do not figure them out, that they are lying to you, by looking at their information and starting to challenge them, they're going to keep on feeding you information. So as 2001 progressed, it got to a point where in September, right before 9/11, if that's just a coincidence happened there, but the analysts in the community, the analysts in BND, CIA, DIA, and SIS, the analysts are all in love with this guy. They have just enamored with the source.
Who they've never met.
They've never met.
Never talked to.
But they're reading his very polished reporting, and they're believing it. I read it too. It sounded really, really plausible. But the operations officers in all these different intelligence organizations, they have to deal with sources directly. When you deal with someone directly, you're not really impressed. You know, if they don't come off right away as impressing you, you're going to start to question their credibility. And so analysts don't deal with sources directly normally. And so the analysts had never met this guy, but the ops officers have. And the German ops officers I'm talking about in the BND. So they're dealing directly with Kerbal, and he is a pain to deal with. He's demanding. He wants everything. He wants them to help him to move his furniture for him when they move him from apartments. And he thought they were just his servants. The ops officers, the German ops officers, are getting tired of dealing with this. The analysts, the German analysts, are still in love with this guy. So the ops officers finally get fed up. And in September, early September 2001, they decide, we're done with this guy. And they terminate their clandestine relationship with him. That cuts
this
off.
This is the BND? The BND. Analyst?
So this is the BND.
That's September of when?
2001.
3 days before 9/11.
Yeah.
Wow. 3 days before.
Yeah, as Bob mentioned, they cut their ties with him. So he has no financial support. You know, he's got an apartment he's got to pay for. He's got to pay for his livelihood. So he has to go find a job. Now, when you're an emigre in a country in Europe, you can only take the menial labor jobs. So you're not going to go replace someone, you know, a German citizen in a more important job. And his engineering background wasn't very good anyway. So he got a job at Burger King. Now, this is, you know, right before 9/11, they terminate him. 9/11 happens. Look at the change in the environment in the U.S. and all these other countries. When 9/11 happened, fear, I mean, it's just a fearful environment, a lot of fear mongering. You know, oh, my God, the terrorists are coming to get us. So all of a sudden, the Bush administration saw that as an opportunity to not just take out bin Laden and al-Qaeda, but to also go after Saddam. They had been wanting to do it for a long time. Right. So they did use this as painting Saddam as an imminent threat, you know, for regime change. That was their policy. This gave them the opportunity. So as Bob pointed out, everything changed after 9/11. Where Kerbal's reporting had been questioned and suspicious that it may be fabrication and terminated him, now all of a sudden after 9/11, it's like the most important thing since sliced bread. Because
so
the
wait
Bush
a minute,
administration
you said earlier on the CIA got it so wrong. Right. But in a way, that's not really what your story is about, because what made them.
Well, they did get it wrong.
They got it wrong, but
they got everything wrong and they relied on Kerbal.
Right. But they knew better that I guess what I'm asking is.
Well, a few people.
Yeah.
Or suspect.
Yeah. Because
you see institution.
Yeah. Because CIA, DIA, SIS, BND, these are all big organizations made up of people. Some people believe something, some people inside don't. So when you talk about the CIA getting something right or wrong, okay, you have to figure out who inside there were the ones who got it wrong and who got it right. So in this case with Kerbal, his reports are all suspicious to the operations officers, but the analysts never let go. They thought, nope, he's credible. So when 9/11 happens, the Bush administration wants the CIA to provide them with all the threat information on Saddam that we have. And of course, here's Kerbal's reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And they're not told.
No,
wait. Let me finish one thing here. Because so all of a sudden this information is reborn and it's considered credible by the analysts, not by the operations officers, the analysts. The analysts are the ones who are communicating with the policymakers. In those new finished intelligence reports, there is absolutely no mention that Kerbal has been terminated by the handling agency. None. Mm. The policymakers don't know this.
And none of the contradictions are in the reporting.
None of it is included in there.
Right.
So one of the things that I find fascinating as an outsider and as a reporter was trying to understand this process at the time. And what struck me about CIA at that point was how much it reminded me of high school, right? The fights between the analysts and the DO and the personalities. And I just heard something yesterday. Jerry, you probably know this, but I did not know this before. So there's this famous note that the station chief in Berlin writes back and says the Germans are getting nervous. There's real problems with this guy. And in his book, Tennant says, I never got that note. And what I heard yesterday was because a certain individual at Langley was fighting with the station chief in Berlin and said, I'm not passing this thing on. Screw this guy, because they've been mortal enemies for years, like in high school. And he just said, so it was like all about personality clashes.
Well, I want to ask you about that, Bob, because there was some high drama in the days and hours before Powell's speech at the UN, where some people were trying to warn higher ups, you can't rely on this. Powell can't use this. Tyler Drumheller, who I think was in charge of European affairs, said that he was warned by the BND that he was not reliable, and he alerted John McLaughlin, the deputy to George Tenet. Yes. McLaughlin says he didn't remember that happening. So there were people trying to blow the whistle before Powell uses the curveball example as almost exhibit A in his speech to the UN.
And they were all on the operations side. In all, even the Brits, the British operations officers were trying to warn, watch out, this guy's information. Remember, in the WND Commission report, there's a British senior operations officer who said, hey, agency, especially WinPAC, this guy, Curveball, is exhibiting characteristics typical of a fabricator. And he fought with WinPAC over this and tried to get them to understand, look, the operations officers, think this guy is a fabricator. And you guys are running with this and not telling the policymakers any of the problems with this guy. And that's what really my book is all about, is this battle between the two groups in each of these organizations as they tried to push forward information. Some of it would get blocked and others it would flow, especially if it agreed with what the analysis was, that Saddam is a threat, an imminent threat. He has WMD. That kind of analysis flew through the process. But the ops officers kept getting stopped, saying, wait a minute, there's problems with this source. His credibility is in serious question. So do you understand? I'm not just talking about CIA. I'm talking about DIA, SIS, and BND. We were all the same. Operations officers didn't like the guy. Analysts loved him.
Did Curveball have any relationship or get any encouragement from Ahmed Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress?
No, except
none.
Just one thing, and that's when Curveball's older brother. We learned this when I went into Iraq and investigated. Curveball's older brother Fatah worked for the INC. He was the senior. Yes.
That's a relationship
In 2001, in summer of 2001, the older brother, Fatah, called Curveball in Germany and said, hey, you know, how you doing? Nice to talk to you again, my brother and all that, my younger brother. Hey, do you have any information on Iraq WMD? Do you know of any problem? You were an engineer there. Do you know anything that's happening in Iraq? And Curveball said, No, I don't have anything. I just worked on some agricultural projects, which was true.
Mike, do you remember where Chalabi was on it was January 28th, 2002? He was sitting
was
in
that 2002
Laura
or 2003? I think it
for Palestine.
I think it was 2003.
Right.
Yes.
2003.
Well, I am. That's interesting because I am reliably informed that Chalabi privately took credit for Curveball.
No, he didn't. Yeah, he didn't know anything about it. And we even.
But if the brother was working for the INC, where?
That.
In London or where was the brother?
His brother was in Turkey.
His brother was in Turkey.
Yeah.
So you don't think that this was ever communicated up the chain?
No, we searched for any information to either confirm that or refute that the INC was behind this. But no, the older brother was told by Curveball, no, I don't have anything. And that's what he passed back to Chalabi. Chalabi also came out publicly and said, I don't know who this guy is that supposedly works for me. Because Fatah, the older brother.
I heard
and
that.
Look,
I
went
that
to.
As well. That his people were claiming credit, but they were after the fact.
Yeah,
after the fact.
When we talked to the brother,
we
found all this out that he had made this phone call and everything. The Germans never knew any of this, but we found it out because we talked to the brother. So when that came out, and we investigated because we knew the analysts are going to lock onto this and say, "Oh, see, we weren't just dumb believing this stuff. We weren't just misled." The INC had this sophisticated project to fool us. And so we wanted to kill that right away. So we investigated that whole thing and wrote back, no, no, no. INC didn't know anything about this. The only thing they did was question the brother one time.
Isn't it possible that that phone call from the brother who worked for the INC kind of encouraged Curveball to make up his tall tales?
No, because as Bob knows, he already made up that story. This, remember, the brother
said he told, but you said he told the brother he knew nothing.
Yes, in 2001. But when did Bob, when did Curveball start reporting? January and February of 2000. So he already came up with his story when he was in Germany, because as Bob knows, Curveball got to the Zirndorf Refugee Center and started talking to the other refugees about, I want to get German citizenship and have them give me, and see, I have an Iraqi passport. They're going to give me all this stuff. And the other emigre said, hey, look, this is a very long process. It's going to take you 5-10 years to ever get there, if you ever do. So Curveball decided, I got to come up with a story, because the emigres told him also, however, if you're important to the BND, they'll get you a free ride through this process much faster than the regular emigre system. So that told Curveball, I got to come up with a story that's going to, they're going to latch on to, so that then I'm valuable to them and they'll put me through the process faster, which is exactly what happened.
All right. So you've now written this massive book deconstructing all that went down.
Can I add one thing in here? Because Karen, yeah, I talked about this a little earlier. You call it a massive book. It's 850 pages. But
that's, I think, what, that qualifies.
Yes. But that's, again, that's what I submitted to the agency. The agency is trying to redact. They're actually trying to redact all of it. But they're going to try and redact as much as they can. If they redact hundreds of pages, what do I have left? So I gave them 850 pages that I don't intend to publish, but I want to get what I can through the process so that I do have enough for a book to be published.
But but one of the things they are saying is classified is the identity of Curveball, Rafid Al-Janabi. And the guy's been on 60 Minutes. He has been publicly out there for years.
Yeah, look,
what
I'm not looking for a fight.
What basis do they have for?
I'm not looking for a fight with CIA. To me, this is absurd.
You're suing them.
So yes, yes, I realize that. But I mean,
that's kind of a fight.
Okay. Before I even filed the lawsuit, I thought this is absurd that we. Curveball, if you go look on the internet, you can find everything you want about this guy and that he was the source. So before I submitted my book, I submitted FOIAs, Freedom of Information Act, for about 120 documents from CIA and DIA. It's everything I investigated. I proved it was all false. Why is it still classified after 25 years? It was classified 25 years ago. That should have been released.
How long ago did you submit the manuscript to them for review?
That was in January of 2025. I submitted FOIAs before that in 2024. And I was told it's going to take 2.5 years before they even get to start to process the FOIAs. So when I submitted my manuscript, the CIA came back and said, well, until your FOIA is clear, we're not going to review your book.
Oh.
That's why that Mark Zod and I filed the lawsuit, is because they are obligated to review the book. But they are saying, not until your FOIAs are gone through there, then will we even touch this. So what they've come back and said is, well, we'll start reviewing your book, but we're probably going to redact everything, the entire book.
Did they put that in writing?
Yes. Yes.
Really?
Yes. So their lawyer has said, their lawyer has said that.
I hope I really hope you succeed in getting these FOIAs through. I look forward to reading the original reports and find out what exactly.
And that's important for my book,
right? And whether it was twisted along the way or amped up at what or how it changed over time, because with 90 of them. Obviously, that story must have moved and grooved in different ways. And I would really love
That's why I wanted the reporting released, is because you can read these reports, because that's what we investigated. Every claim he made in those reports is what we chased down. And that's why the story is such a fascinating story, is how we did that And it's also distressing about how we were obstructed from doing that, because we became kind of the skunk at the garden party. When we investigated this on the ground in Iraq, we made everybody mad. CIA, DIA, SIS, and BND.
Yes, but this...
Everybody got mad at us.
Did you ever meet Curveball?
No, no, I have not met him. Others that I work with have met him. And
yeah. How about that doctor who was sent to evaluate him, and Les, who said that he had liquor on his breath early in the morning.
He'd been out drinking. So I didn't meet him, but I went to his family's house. I went when I got to Iraq, as Bob and I have discussed this. I went to Iraq. I was there in June, but of 2003. I went back in September because I had to come back to CIA headquarters to get access to all the information that had been withheld from me. I can't investigate him if I can't have access to all his information. I was still never read into the program, but I got a hold of the files from my colleagues who were the lead analysts on that. It had everything in there. And of course, in there is all the things that went bad on Curveball, all the derogatory information. So I used that when I went back in September, and I got back in September I got back in Iraq on September 3rd of 2003. We went to see his immediate supervisor at the engineering center on September 5th. And the guy told us, that guy, Rafid, well, he walked away from his job at the engineering center at the very final few days of 1994. And we had no choice but to terminate his employment on the first few days of 1995. When he told us that, we knew right then, this is all a fabrication, all of it, because everything Curveball reported was after 1995.
So to wrap up here, a question for both of you, what lessons should we take from this rather amazing story of a fabricator whose claims get used as a basis for going to war?
Okay, I'm very glad you're asking that question, because the point of my book is not to embarrass people over mistakes that were made. I made mistakes. Hell, I thought there was WMD in Iraq before the war. And I believed in Curveball. It wasn't until I started to learn about him after the war and investigate him that I realized all of this fell apart. It was all a fabrication. So the point of my book is to help people learn what happened and why it happened. That analysts became biased toward that judgment. They weren't stupid. The analysts just became biased toward the judgment that Saddam has WMD before the war. It wasn't until we got into Iraq that we learned that was wrong. So I'm hoping this helps people, the general public, to understand how we got into this war and with the most significant source and how it all went wrong. But also, I wrote this for my colleagues in the intelligence community, not just in the U.S., but in the foreign countries, our allied partners as well, so that they can learn. Watch out if this happens to you. Watch for these signals, these signatures that are happening, to start going, well, wait a minute. We've got this great source, but maybe we should look at this source a lot closer before we start using it with the policymakers.
Bob, I want to come to you on the lessons from all this. But I got one last question for Jerry. In the years since, we have learned that Saddam deliberately wanted us and the rest of the world to believe that he had WMD because he thought that would be a deterrence for the Iranians and an overall deterrence perhaps for others. And I just wonder, because that's not an argument or a thought that I ever recall being expressed in the run-up to the Iraq war. And we have this giant intelligence community with all these analysts. Did anybody ever consider the idea that maybe Saddam was bluffing?
First, let me start off by, I disagree with that. Saddam was trying to get out from UN sanctions. I challenge anybody to show me where he actually said and gave this impression he has WMD. It doesn't make sense. Saddam is trying to get out from under sanctions with the UN. The UN is in his country going around looking for any evidence that he still has WMD. Saddam even threatened his scientists with death if UNSCOM found anything He didn't want anything retained. He wanted it all destroyed and gone. Because every time UNSCOM...
Then why not come clean, let the inspectors in, show that he had nothing, and put the whole thing to rest?
He did. And what did we come away with? Everybody came back. The UNSCOM inspectors came back and said, we can't find anything. We can't find no evidence that he has reconstituted his program. But the analysts, the intelligence analysts are all out there, and the politicians and all these different countries, especially the U.S., are saying, no, Saddam has reconstituted. Based on what? Nobody had any evidence except some fabricators who were giving us this stuff. So,
Mike, I'm gonna support Jerry on this one. My memory of, in the sense that in the debriefs of Saddam, it became clear that he thought we were smarter than we were. He thought that we understood that this was all aimed not at the U.S. but at bluffing Iran, and that, as Jerry said, the inspectors were all over the country. Right? I remember talking to a guy who was on missile inspectors, and they were sent to someplace. Oh my God! You should see these long things they're holding them, and they were chicken shacks, you know, chicken coops places, whatever. They got T-shirts that said, you know, chicken buffer missile association.
That was our doing. They went to one of Korbal's sites that he said there was a secret laboratory buried under this, hidden under a chicken coop. And they went there and there was no hidden site. So they got the T-shirts that said, you know, a ballistic chicken inspector. And
yeah. So I agree with him. I think that it wasn't just CIA, as you remember, Mike. Most of the media, every think tank in Washington, Congress fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. And it was pretty much happening elsewhere in London and in Berlin and Paris and so on. Not on the streets, but in the
right. And if you go look at this
and why they believed it, because they didn't trust Saddam.
The inspectors have said right before the war, UNMOVIC inspectors are saying we are finding nothing. No aluminum tubes, no uranium from Africa, no UAVs carrying
CW. That's after the war.
That's all on the record. They have come out and said it's not there. And so
one of the really instructive things is, if I remember this, so I was there the day that Powell spoke, and he gives this incredibly, I was convinced, persuasive presentation. And the Iraqi minister at the UN, the secretary or ambassador at the UN, issues a lengthy statement afterwards that I remember looking at, you know, throw it away. It's useless. It means nothing. If you look at it after what we know, it was absolutely dead on spot on. Correct. It was absolutely more correct than anything Powell said that day.
Yeah, lessons, please.
Let me get to your lessons.
Okay.
We're running out of time. There are two lessons that I take from this, okay? One of them is that after 9/11, the take was we failed to connect the dots. In Iraq, they made up the dots. That's the problem, is they took a very disparate kinds of things and they pieced it together because there was no access. It was a denied site after the 1998, after the bombing, and they just sort of filled in the holes with these elaborate schemes. That was number one. The number two thing is, for the intelligence community, as was with everything else, if you want it bad, you get it bad, right? They really wanted to find something. They put the word out, and every dirtbag out there came in with a story. Chalabi was the biggest one, but you know, that's what they got.
One follow-up to the lessons learned question is, how does this apply to our current war in the Middle East against Iran?
So I think there's a real key similarity, which is that before the Iraq war, the inspectors were kicked out because the Clinton bombed Iraq, right, in 1998. The inspectors are kicked out. And CIA goes blind. Everybody goes blind. It's a denied space. And so they make up these stories about what's happening inside, and that leads to the disaster. In the case of Iran, Trump rips up. There's a working agreement, the JCPOA, that the Obama administration signed in 2015 to limit Iran's nuclear program, to ship out all the enriched uranium or 98% of it and have IAEA inspectors and cameras and so on. Trump, for whatever his reasons, decides to rip it up in 2018. The inspectors are still allowed to go for a while. Trump then bombs them. So now, and during that, over this last period of time between 2018 and now, Iran decides the hell with it. If, as long as we don't have the Americans, we don't have this agreement. So they go, they have now 1,000 pounds of in uranium. It used to be a 10% enrichment. Now it's at 60%. As far as we know, despite Trump's claims that it was obliterated, it's all still there. So it was in both cases, errors on our side that led to the disastrous political decisions that led to war.
Jerry?
Right. Right. I mean, look at the similarities between Iraq and Iran. You know, your same buzzwords are being used by the administration. Imminent threat, WMD, regime change. I mean, this is Iraq 2.0. We're doing this again. And we don't know really. I'm not current on what the agency knows in Iran, but IAEA, of course, has confirmed they do have some enriched uranium. But, you know, when you have enriched, you still have a second half of your weapons program. You've got to create a device to be able to use this. We don't know. Does anybody know what they've done on that side?
Well, so, the ballistic missiles maybe.
Yes, could but you be have to have a warhead, and you have to have a device in that warhead that is a nuclear device. And you have to get from the enriched uranium in a gas into a metal form to form, you know, either a gun assembly device or an implosion device. We don't know anything about that. So
they know something about it, but the estimates are, you know, 8 months to a year away. So, it's been 8 months to a year away since 2003.
Right.
So yeah, I'm concerned we've gone down the same road again, and the American public has been misled with the same buzzwords we used on Iraq.
Excellent point. Well, just to wrap up here, Jerry, I want to thank you and Bob for joining us. And I look forward to your book finally clearing all these bureaucratic hurdles. So when it comes out, I can put it next to Bob's book on the curveball shelf of my library.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye, guys.
Thank you.
All right,
thanks, Karen.
Good to see you.
All right. Thank you.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show. Speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark. Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.